Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. I want to start by reminding you that KBOO Community Radio is volunteer-powered, non-commercial radio, which means we can discuss controversial issues like the mainstream media cover-up of the horrors in Gaza without fear of losing our funding. If you can, please support this important voice in our community by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or send us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. The first half of our show today will be devoted to a discussion of degrowth. Joe Clement speaks with Paul Messersmith-Glavin about the need to put the brakes on economic growth in order not only to mitigate climate catastrophe, but to build a world based on fulfillment of human needs rather than the imperative to turn a profit. During the second half of our show, we return to the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the growing resistance to it. We'll begin with a brief clip from Makdizi Street, a podcast about the Middle Eastern crisis from a Palestinian point of view. Following that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker review current legal struggles against efforts to cleanse the U.S. of critics of the war on Gaza through deportation and the growing struggles on the street to expose and resist ICE deportation sweeps. We begin now with Joe Clement in conversation with local activist and anarchist scholar Paul Messersmith-Glavin about the concepts of degrowth, drawing from Paul's review of Kohai Sato's book, Marx in the Anthropocene. His review will be published this summer in New Politics, an independent socialist journal.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm here today talking with Paul Messersmith-Glavin about the politics and idea of degrowth communism. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
So Paul is a Portland local, does radical acupuncture, is an anarchist scholar and contributor to different publications, is one of the founders of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and contributes to their periodical Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. It's got a review coming out in the summer edition of New Politics. He's going to be reviewing a book that was published a couple years ago by Japanese Marxist scholar Kohei Sato called Marx in the Anthropocene. It is part of a number of books that Kohei Sato has written about Karl Marx and his explorations of ecology and communes and non-capitalist peoples. Paul, how did you get into learning about degrowth, and what have you learned along the way?
In 2007, 2008, I spent a year in China, and China is ecological disaster. I got very depressed there because you can't really see the sky, you can't see the sun. The part of China we were in Sichuan province, in Chengdu, is very smoggy. The environment there doesn't allow for the smog to dissipate, and really I took that kind of smog into my lungs and it turned into grief and became very depressed. I'm thinking that I was experiencing the future of life on this planet. And I couldn't even believe that China, this environment, existed on the same planet as Portland, Oregon. Because back in that time, Portland summers were beautiful, you know, crisp, clean, 70, 80 degrees after July 4th. And it's changed recently due to climate change. But at the time, it was a real contrast. And so coming back to the United States, my partner and I formed a study group to look into the causes of climate change and to try to get an intellectual handle on this phenomena that we had experienced in China, this ecological disaster area. And we spent a lot of time looking into the causes of the changing climate and what we could do about it, and got a handle on the economic foundations of capitalism in terms of how it's changing the climate, and began speaking to other organizers about how the changing climate will influence their work. And then most recently, I began participating in a Walter Benjamin study group where we read the theses on the concept of history.
Walter Benjamin, if folks didn't know, was an early 20th century Jewish mystic and Marxist and anti-fascist scholar and theoretician who wrote influentially about the themes of history and violence and revolutionary agency.
And so reading Benjamin was really great. And I knew about Sato's work on degrowth communism and his exploration into the later Marx. And for a long time, I had it in my head to do something looking at Walter Benjamin and Sato's work and the implications of that for ecological organizing and class-based organizing and transforming society.
Yeah, I've covered degrowth on The Old Mole a couple of years ago, and it has definitely gained even more steam than it had at that time. But I think that it's worth kind of reviewing some of these terms that have come out in the conversation so far, because, you know, every movement in every generation is in some way kind of reinventing its way of talking about the world as the world changes, but it inherits the terms and the situations those terms came out of from the past. So I just want to talk a bit about like what degrowth even means, how it is related to the obvious corollary concept of growth, and you know what some of the struggles around using this language have been. So when we talk about or hear people talk about degrowth, what are they really talking about?
But talking about interrupting the process of capital accumulation. So in my mind, I equate growth, economic growth, with the accumulation of capital. I know that that's a very specific definition, that there's other ways of defining growth. Some people include like job creation or increasing wages as part of the growth process. But for me, in essence, growth is about the accumulation of capital, which is accumulated off the backs of working people. So people that work are creating wealth, and that wealth is then stolen by the capitalists. And that's a process of economic growth. Mm-hmm. Part of it is interrupting that process of exploitation of labor and producing for exchange as opposed to producing for need.
Well, I mean, a lot of what we're talking about and looking at when we consider degrowth has to do with the material world, with the way that we actually live in it, the way that we take from or use material resources of it and interact with the material living systems of the earth. And when we are talking about capital accumulation, there's, you know, this abstract side to it, but then there's this very real concrete side, which is that materials are transformed to be sold on markets, to be utilized in exchanges. And that process of feeding the exchange itself is where we run into so many just completely bonkers problems when it comes to the exhaustion of what the bountiful earth actually has. Because we aren't talking about producing for just use by humans, by people. We're talking about producing for the sake of making these exchanges happen, and being able to tease those apart is necessary to understand like what it is we want to degrow and what it means for the environment to interrupt these processes. Because when we talk about using the earth to survive, to thrive, it's very different than using it to make money.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Marx in Capital talks about the original sources of all wealth being the soil and the worker. So for degrowth communism and Sato's work, basically you're interrupting the exploitation of labor and the exploitation of nature and creating a society that does neither.
You mentioned John Bellamy Foster kind of pioneering metabolic rift as a way of kind of talking about the environmental impact of capitalism and of the economy. What is meant by metabolic and what is meant by rift in that idea?
Yeah, that's a good question. For Marx, what it means to be human is to transform nature through labor. So we make things and change things and use nature in a way that we produce different things, right? And so the interaction of humans and nature is essential to human identity, what it means to be human. And the labor process itself is essential to what it means to be human. Under capitalism, that process is alienated. So workers create things which are then taken from them, commodities, and sold on the market, and they are not paid the full amount of the value of that commodity that's sold on the market. Hence, the capitalists make a profit off the labor of workers. Marx uses this metaphor of metabolism in Capital that talks about this human interaction with nature, this metabolism. He uses this metaphor of metabolism. So when that is a healthy relationship, when you're working with nature in a way that's not exploitative, then that's a healthy metabolism. But a rift occurs when capitalism basically exploits human labor and treats nature as both a resource and a place to dump waste. So there's this unhealthy relationship between humans and nature. There's a metabolic rift as opposed to a healthy metabolism.
In Marx's later studies into ecology and into agroecology and the biology or chemistry of soil health, you know, he recognizes how the way that agriculture had been developed in the industrial period near cities was changing the way that the soil actually was able to support any life on it. Nutrients in the soil are a finite thing. They need to be replenished. And this disruption of what is a cycle of resources that don't travel very far. They don't travel naturally for the reasons that they travel for markets, which take things from all over the world, mm-hmm. and capital has been global for hundreds of years now. And the you know, early development of chemical fertilizers was exploiting lands thousands of miles away from the European countries that were investing in the extractive labor to take those nutrients from other parts of the world.
Yeah, and that's how capitalism contributes to the changing climate, right? So you're producing commodities for exchange that people don't necessarily need. It's not, you're not meeting human needs, you're creating wants through advertising and then producing commodities which are packaged in all this crap that then is thrown away and goes into landfills. And the stuff is produced on the other side of the planet, exploiting human labor in various countries in this global south, and then transported via fossil fuel burning ships and planes and trucks and trains and everything to get over on the other side of the world to be sold to people that don't need these things. They're not fulfilling fundamental needs necessarily.
Yeah, it extends into, you know, things that are so structural and basic to how most people live that they have a hard time seeing them as even possibly optional. And the big outlier on this is cars. Motor culture and the way that it's transformed human society, the landscape, climate change is driven by motor culture, but it's also driven by the energy demand of moving these resources across these vast distances for the sake of satisfying markets, not for the sake of satisfying human needs or human needs that can't be satisfied differently if less profitably. I think that we want to kind of recognize that it's not just a matter of letting go of superficial desires that are put into us by advertisements. We can't get away from how these lifestyles, if we're going to even call them that, are imposed on us. They're more of a kind of political regime that make us into willing subjects that do work for capital.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, for decades now, scientists have been saying we have to stop extracting and burning fossil fuels, right? And the capitalists in charge of things, the ruling class, have been ignoring that. But that demand and that scientific need for us to stop changing the climate in order for humanity to survive by stopping the extraction and burning of fossil fuels resonates with Walter Benjamin's idea of activating the emergency brake, which in turn resonates with the notion of a degrowth communism. It's stopping what we're doing that's going to endanger the future of humanity by continuing to burn fossil fuels and do all these other things that we're doing based upon that process. Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of Marxists today still argue for economic growth and productivism, productionism, in particular Jacobin magazine, which in the spring issue was all glorifying progress and growth and all these things.
Private jets for everyone.
Private jets for everyone, which is just such, I mean, like, these people, I don't know what they're thinking. Like, the ecological insustainability of their program is just, it should be obvious.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Paul Messersmith Glavin about the politics of degrowth in the work of Kohei Sato, a Marxist scholar from Japan, as well as other Marxists in recent years who have made this turn towards ecological analysis. Degrowth isn't just a Marxist movement. It isn't just a Marxist analysis. What are some of the other dimensions to the way this movement has grown up? What other sort of intersecting concerns or movements are part of what we mean by degrowth?
Yeah, I think if the degrowth movement is going to be serious, it has to take capitalism seriously. And the person that took capitalism the most seriously was Karl Marx. So it's important to read Marx and understand capitalism and understand how it's capitalism is the essential driving force behind not only climate change, but the broader ecological crisis we find ourselves in, and also human misery writ large. What Marx came to was very, in the last years of his life, was looking at non-capitalist peoples, looking at the natural sciences, and basically expanding his consciousness about what it means to be human, right? And indigenous peoples, you know, for millennia have lived in a way that is much more sustainable and ecological, basically in a no-growth fashion. Indigenous populations in what's now called North America did not necessarily exploit human labor for the profit of an elite few. Some tribes and nations may have. David Graeber and David Wengrow do a good job of looking at the nature and the diversity of native populations and various forms of social organization. But native peoples generally show an example of how to live in harmony with nature and how to live cooperatively amongst other human beings, which is what the goal of degrowth communism is. You know, feminists have looked at the role of reproductive labor and care and things like that and critiqued society in terms of its patriarchal values and structures and social relationships, and we can learn much from feminism. So indigenous and feminist ideas are both, you know, very important, as well as anarchism. You know, I'm an anarchist, I'm not a Marxist, but I enjoy reading Marx, and I think it's important to read Marx. But anarchism and the history of anarchism is a history of developing cooperative forms of organization, collectives and co-ops and things like that, and reorganize the society in a cooperative fashion, which is also another dimension of what any kind of degrowth communist society would look like.
Yeah, because, I mean, degrowth gets at this question of power in a way that we aren't often asked to think about. The way in which the built environment, the way in which our life ways are what drive, you know, our activity, our actions, and those who control those factors in our lives really have power over all of us. And trying to wrest that power from capital looks like making things that are available accessible and making it possible for people to enjoy utilities like movement in a communal way on our buses and trains. And the way that degrowth is drawing us to look at how power is constituted in society looks like these local projects that happen in your neighborhood or even in your building, but they also look like these large projects of what we should call society, where we are trying to coordinate our capacities and resources for everyone to shake the power of the ruling class, that they have this power over us because they control how we live. And being able to name what's problematic or constraining about the way we live is a important first step to kind of zeroing in on what we really need to change.
Yeah, I mean, like right now you look at the grassroots community resistance to ICE raids, and that's an example of the kind of direction that society needs to go in, is that kind of like collective mass-based resistance to authoritarianism and proto-fascism. So that gives me hope, certainly. And that's an example of the kind of direct action that people can take in their communities to defend their neighbors and their family members and their coworkers. And the way that like these apps are spreading and to identify ICE in the neighborhood and things like that, and the way people are rising up in Los Angeles and resisting these things is all a reason for hope, right? And points in the direction that society needs to go. And it points to a different, fundamentally different society, a society based on cooperation and love and care, which is the exact opposite of the kind of structures that are being reinforced and militarized right now in the United States.
Degrowth contributes to that when we think of how initiatives like the Buy Nothing groups put people into relationships with each other, have them interacting in a way that makes it familiar to reach out to those who you know and those who you don't know to get help, and be familiar with what it feels like to have something to offer. And that kind of pre-political organizing is what we need to always be doing in order to have the muscles, in order to, you know, go after kind of more ambitious goals, like the overthrow of capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, during the pandemic, there was a proliferation of mutual aid projects, neighbors taking care of neighbors, and people in various workplaces and communities taking care of each other. And that was all over, like, Brooklyn, for instance, and the New Yorker wrote a whole article about the proliferation of mutual aid projects. And that's an example of people cooperating and taking care of each other. And that has to be generalized throughout society. And so it's kind of like both the Wobblies' idea of creating the new society in the shell of the old. We need to create what we're going to replace capitalism with, right, from the bottom up. But we also need to basically take all the wealth that's been created by the working class historically and give it back to the people that created that wealth, which is everyday working people. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need, based on that principle. So when people like criticize degrowth as being like advocating for people living more poorly, or like generalizing poverty or things like that, I think that's a bogus argument. There's more wealth than we possibly need if it just has to be distributed equally throughout society. There's also the communal wealth that Marx talks about. There's the everyday wealth that we have of community gardens and things like that, the sharing that we have on an everyday level. But there's also a lot of wealth that needs to be expropriated, which is the revolutionary element. It's not just lifestyle change. It means we need a revolutionary movement to seize the means of production and transform those means of production, and also expropriate the wealth that's been stolen from the working class and given back to people that produced it.
Yeah, and you know, there are examples of working class movements that have sought to kind of like do something different with that power that they were seizing. A good example is the Lucas Plan. The workers in this aerospace company were getting sick and tired of producing for war, and instead saw their technical capacities as still being valuable, but designing things like buses and other things of peaceful use that people need or would benefit from. That needs to come more into the conversation about what's the point of forming a union. Is it to just, you know, get your cut of the flow of capital that your labor enables, or is it to interrupt that flow and do something with it that changes that whole scenario? You know, degrowth is not anti-technology. It is, if anything, in a lot of ways, high technology with a kind of different perspective on how it's actually implemented or used. But there's also just the kind of material question of, for example, we need plastics for medical resources. Like, there are legitimate and widely felt need for plastic. We're wasting the capacity of the earth to produce and or sustain the presence of plastics on garbage. And degrowth looks like redistributing that capacity and those resources, so that if we have to use something that's potentially toxic or has these environmental implications, that it's used for only the things that really benefit humanity and in proportion to that need, and not, say, the need for a company to increase its sales.
Yeah, not to mention, like, microplastics invading our internal organs and our brains and the oceans. And it's like every time I take out the garbage, I'm just like, where's all this go? And like, why does everything have to come in so much packaging? And, you know, what kind of society is this that's just like producing all this crap, endangering the future of humanity in the process?
Degrowth also fits in with a human need to take care of things. And part of that looks like how humans care for each other. But the idea of care, especially if we like want to borrow from different indigenous perspectives on like our relationship with the world as a living whole of some sort, that how we care for the built environment, how we care for the things that we take the trouble of hewing from nature to make is also part of that ethos, that we make things to last. We make them to be repairable. We repair them. We use them in a way that does not act like it's okay to just throw them away when they break down.
Yes, right, exactly. When I was in college, there was this guy that lived in town who basically sold like 3-speed bikes and like taught people how to fix them. And people like all over campus rode these bicycles that were easy to maintain and got you around. And this was like his life work, you know, and that's like being a craftsman, you know, a craftsperson, like doing things that are sustainable, that help people, that provide a quality of life that's better.
I mean, I like you hitting on the idea of making life easier. And that is explicitly like part of the core platform that the Democratic Socialist running for mayor in New York, Zoran Mamdani, has like put front and center for consideration, that Zoran will cut costs and make life easier. And there's really a lot more to it, but there also doesn't need to be a lot more to it as far as getting started with the idea of like, what are we really talking about when we talk about degrowth? We're talking about cutting out the crap and making life easier.
Yeah, and we're talking about creating an abundance, not the Democratic Party notion of abundance that Ezra Klein and other holes in the Democratic Party are putting forward, but genuine abundance and sharing and cooperation and increasing the quality of life as opposed to the quantity of life, as opposed to the number of things that you can buy. It's like, how many needs are being met and how creative are you able to be and how much love do you have in your life and cooperation and friends and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's what we're talking about. And the left needs to start talking in a way that's attractive. The social movements of the 1960s, that's where everyone wanted to be. It was a welcoming, joyous place, and that's where everything was. And the left is no longer that. It's the opposite of that. And the right is where people want to be, because the right is writing a story that gives people a sense of meaning and belonging in a time of crisis.
Well, this is definitely a conversation that I think bears going on another time. I'd like to have you back on the Old Mole this summer, and we can dive a bit more into, you know, what it means to degrow the economy and change society, and look at the appealing possibilities, and not just ask these theoretical questions, but look more closely at like what is being done and what could we be doing next.
Yeah, I'd love to come back.
Well, this has been Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Paul Messersmith-Glavin about Kohei Sato's work on degrowth, on the broader movement organized around this idea of degrowth, and the really meaty questions of like, what does it mean to change society?
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Wake up, fellow workers. Why do you sleep so sound? The whole revenue that bosses keep taking is gonna burn this whole world down. Go away, fellow workers. Go away, that we need to win. Pretty contracts keep me distracted, and labor laws leaving me for dead. Get along, fellow workers. Get along, you have history. The struggle we're in is a long one, spanning more than a century. In the day when we withheld the labor, workers had the power to win. Slowdowns and sit-ins persisted, and union power feared boss men. Take your time, fellow workers. Take your time on a long working day. Take your time from them bosses. Take control of your labor today. It's your time, fellow workers. It's your time to save the day. It's your time, not them bosses. Don't let them waste it until it's too late. train. If we don't, then it's all gonna crash on a slow burning doom's day. Organize, organize, fellow workers, take control of your own workplace. If we don't, the bosses off our backs, then we'll enjoy living at our own damn pace.
The music you just heard was composed and performed by our own Joe Clement. Before that, Joe was speaking with Paul Messersmith Glavin about degrowth. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Last month on The Old Mole, Laurie Mercier spoke with Usama Makdisi, who along with brothers Sari and Kareem co-host the podcast Makdisi Street. This morning, we play a brief excerpt from a recent episode titled Israel is a Dependent Empire, in which the brothers discuss shifting public opinion of Israel's brutal genocide. They take up the case of Gary Lineker, BBC sports broadcaster and former footballer in Great Britain, who was recently forced out of his position after expressing his horror about the widespread killing of children in Gaza. The book mentioned is by Sari Makdisi, titled Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial. The poem presented is by Irish Indian poet Nikita Gill about the pediatrician in Gaza who lost 9 of her 10 children to an Israeli attack on her home. Here's Makdisi Street.
Just maybe a final word on Gary Lineker, who, for those that follow football, know he hosted, he was a great English player, football player, and has been hosting Match of the Day for the past, I think, 25 years or so. And had the so-called scandal with the BBC, which is, you know, Match of the Day.
They've been after him for a long time.
They've been after him for a while because Gary Lineker, during the genocide, started to speak up, you know, just in a very basic way of saying, caring for all the children.
The killing of children is wrong.
Of course, the campaign against him and the anti-Semitism campaign against him meant that they basically forced him out of this Match of the Day. And even he resigned from even things that he was supposed to be doing in the upcoming World Cup. He was supposed to be doing commentating for BBC and others. He's resigned from that.
Because he retweeted something, and then he apologized profusely and he deleted the retweet and he apologized profusely.
They were after him anyway. That was an excuse.
Yeah, of course they were.
Even want to repeat that because I think this is just an excuse that they used. And I think it's important just to recognize that people, this is part of this cultural shift that we're seeing, that someone like Gary Lineker, a football player who has nothing to do with politics at all, has come out in a very humanitarian kind of way, expressed his sadness for what was going on.
Not sadness, and his actual outrage.
Yeah, it started sadness. It became outrage as the months kind of rolled by. And then suffered these attacks. And as he was being attacked and eventually forced out, he became more politicized. And it seems that the first thing he did, maybe we can pull it up. The first thing he did in the first day after his retirement from the BBC or after Match of the Day wrapped was in his Instagram account, he put up a poem by a Palestinian.
Here it is. It's on the screen.
Yeah. But do you want to read it out so we can just end with this?
Yeah, I don't know who wrote the poem.
I don't know who wrote this. We don't know who wrote this.
We have to find out who it is. But maybe
it might be him, for all I know.
No. It's a Palestinian.
He shared a poem by a Palestinian. So, Sari, why don't you read it out, and I think we can close and then try to figure out. We need to find out who wrote it, obviously. But in the meantime, if you could just read it out, and then we just close with that.
A mother on duty, caring for her patients, receives the remains of 9 of her children. We are told to ignore this. A child who can barely walk struggles to find safety through flames in the aftermath of a bomb, unable to breathe. We are told to ignore this. George Orwell once said, "The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command." We must refuse to abdicate our duty to each other and see the truth for what is before us. I think that's as good a place as any to end.
That was a little bit of McDeasy Street, which you can find on multiple podcast platforms. Finally, on our show, we have The Left and the Law. Jan Hawkins speaks with Mike Snedeker about the current legal battle in Boston over the free speech rights of college professors and students, as well as the growing resistance to ICE raids and kidnappings in the street.
As the Trump regime continues with mass arrests and deportations of immigrants, polls show that a majority of Americans believe these actions by Immigration and Customs Enforcement have, quote, gone too far, unquote. Many people recoil from the pictures on the news of masked ICE agents on city streets grabbing people who look Latino and whisking them away to crowded jails and deporting thousands of people to places unknown. Well, Mike, the Trump regime has indeed gone very far in its anti-immigrant campaign. How far is too far for the general public? What's your assessment?
Well, we're going to find out. We are finding out as we go. But what has really may change the game is this big, beautiful bill, this budget that just passed, makes ICE's budget about 8 times bigger than it is right now. It provides for the construction of tens of thousands of new prison cells aimed for not criminals, but for people who violated one or another of the deportation rules. It amounts to some $75 billion. And J.D. Vance said that regarding Medicaid, there's a little give and take here and there, but none of that matters compared to the critical thing of the monstrous, or rather, he didn't use the word monstrous, but the enormous increase in the budget provisions for ICE agents and for building new prisons.
The real jewel in the crown for this king is the crackdown on foreigners in general, immigrants, in the Make America White Again campaign.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. The fear, of course, is of dark brown gangsters, criminals, murderers, rapists. But the actual arrests are taking place in the Home Depot parking lot, or they're grabbing people off the streets. The actual behaviors of ICE, which I'm happy to say, are being recorded all over the country, but particularly in the targeted town of Los Angeles right now. LA is being the new version of what Portland was back in 2020 with the Black Lives Matter. It's being made an example of. And Trump has got federal troops. He's got nationalized state troops. They're doing performative sweeps like through MacArthur Park on horseback. You've got long rows of running policemen next to policemen riding on horses, just running through big greens, which are only occupied by children from daycare centers. You've also got masked agents in cars picking people up, grabbing them, disappearing them. And the heartening thing to me is that how much real resistance there is, how much recording of all this is going on, how much mobilization has happened, and how much regular TV stations with daily news are featuring all these details. That's having a profound effect, and I think has led to the poll you started off with, which is that most people are not really happy with all this. So aside from the economic consequences, which are profound.
Because our economy generally is very dependent on immigrant labor, and particularly Latino immigrant labor.
Well, it always has been. It has been at every level. I mean, who raises their children to grow up and work in slaughterhouses, or to be day laborers, or work in hot fields, harvesting food, bending over all day long?
Or in hotels cleaning after rich people in their all-night parties.
That's right. There's a host of jobs that are not pleasant but are essential. And those jobs are all being filled today by immigrants.
There's been a real effective campaign in LA that focuses on naming people, also around the country, naming people who've been detained, having pictures on telephone poles throughout LA, missing mother, you know, is swept away, and that really humanizes the people who've been victims of these sweeps and deportations. What about these different strategies of resistance?
Well, that's a profoundly effective strategy. It makes this nameless dark gangster into a real live person. And it is something that it's made for TV news. So it's featured on nightly newscasts in Los Angeles. And it gives plaintiffs, it works at every level. You know, this works from the very bottom level of the jobs that nobody in their right mind wants to work who was born in the United States, all the way up to the most rarefied high-tech jobs, the most lucrative scientific and technological work. All these jobs are filled by foreigners, and many of these foreigners in universities may not hew the line of politics that the current administration wants. These ideas of pro-Hamas loving university types are symbols of the regime that hates cities. The Trumpian regime hates New York. It hates Los Angeles. It hates places which are dynamic, problematic, troublesome, exciting, infuriating, but real, and the most active and dynamic parts of the United States. But there, too, individuals make the difference. If you feature a person who is a teacher who is afraid to leave the country to appear at a conference because he or she will not be allowed back into this country, you can get into the First Amendment and its real repercussions when you declare that people who hold certain ideas are subject to being deported.
So there are different urban nightmares that haunt these right wingers. One is Los Angeles as a site of what they see unfolding horrors, which has a very large Latino population. It's a very vibrant, big city, but has, and of course, is associated with Hollywood and a very dynamic set of industries that is very different than the Bay Area and the kind of tech world, but has a strong progressive history of resistance to the right-wing forces in California, which are very deep, the role of conservatives in California. But that's different from the scenes in New York and Boston that are more associated with affluent or educated, highly educated immigrants who come in on student visas. Let's talk about the place of those two scenes, the East Coast and the West Coast, in the right-wing popular imaginary, and then turn to the trial unfolding now in Boston with students at the center, students and professors.
Well, you've named it these fear of pullulating masses of foreigners that has guided American politics actually for a long, long time. You know, the irony is I read the LA Times every morning, but today's story featured the fact that the murder rate in Los Angeles has plummeted. It's dropped to lower than it's been since 1968, almost 80 years. And it's similarly dropped all over the country from having gotten really high in the first year or two of the COVID pandemic. This now in Los Angeles, it's about one-fourth of what it was 4 years ago.
Yeah, so what about now this shift with this big ugly bill of a lot of the federal funding moving from everyday policing to immigration enforcement? Apparently that's a very big shift in the priority of criminal justice at the federal level.
Well, it's creating a private police force for Donald Trump. ICE is expanding to unprecedented levels, and $45 billion is set aside to build new prisons to incarcerate people. And an agency that has a budget of about $8 billion this year will have a budget of two, three, four, and five times as much over the next 4 years. So that is truly scary. I mean, there are limits to how far police can go, due precisely to the fact that because Los Angeles is about half Hispanic or Latino, there's going to be a huge popular resistance. That's a 10 million people. And if people are alert and galvanized, the size of the army will not really matter that much. There's only their limits to how big they can grow it. But still, that kind of force within the hands of a completely new system of governorship is unprecedented. Nobody really knows how it's going to break.
Well, let's turn to this site of resistance in the course in the courts on the East Coast. The trial underway in Boston. The case was brought by the chapter by chapters of the American Association of University Professors (AUP) and the Middle East Studies Association or MESA. MESA, following the arrest and detention of non-citizen students and scholars who've spoken out on Palestinian rights. The government claims the authority to deport non-citizens who've committed no crimes but whose presence it deems poses a threat to U.S. foreign policy. And the Ramya Krishnan, an attorney representing the academic groups in the case, argues that the government has adopted, quote, a policy of ideological deportation and is chilling the speech of students and professors alike. Mike, can you comment on the case and its significance?
Well, it's a great trial, and it really is the cutting edge of First Amendment law. And the government is saying, first, it said that there is no First Amendment guarantee for people who are not citizens. Then it walked that back and said, well, there are nuances. And the judge is very dubious, I'm happy to say, about their claim that the First Amendment depends on whether or not you're a citizen. But there are people who are talking about the chilling effect, and they're describing, testifying as to how the fact that people have been, that saying something against, critical against Israel is being promptly characterized as a pro-Hamas view, and therefore violating American foreign policy, and therefore it makes you subject to being deported. The government has waffled saying, well, we're not really doing that. There is no such law. But then when confronted with texts, including statements from the Secretary of State Rubio and Trump himself, saying that they're going to get rid of these people, the government is, it's not clear where their position will finally be. The trial is ongoing now with lots of evidence being presented from people who talk about how they have been inhibited from making statements about what they truly believe, and they've withdrawn op-ed pieces that they've been chilled, in effect, by the fear of being deported or by not being allowed to return to this country.
So, how effective is a line of argument and evidence of that sort? Because, of course, some of these organizations like ADL and AIPAC have gathered up hyperinflated data to support their claims that Palestinian protests on campuses have been threatening to Jewish students by saying they feel uncomfortable, they feel like they can't say what they think. How important is that subjective perception as a legal argument versus the evidence of overt actions of various kinds, of which there are many of students who have been deported, students and faculty disciplined, fired, What about that sense of a perception of a threat versus the actual threat?
It's a fundamental part of the First Amendment, Jan. The idea of a chilling effect has been around for many decades. It's a recognition of the truth that those people who have been publicly banned or from speaking, or who have been threatened with deportation, or who've been actually arrested and seized, are one part of the story of free expression. But a huge part, and this has been understood from the 18th century, is that if you are afraid that that might happen to you, you're not likely to speak. And so the repercussions of those arrests are profound. It's like the tip of an iceberg. 7/8 of the discussion remains underwater. And so people don't say what they believe, or they hesitate in saying it. They debate it. They go through mental anguish or mental gyrations and then decide to talk or not. All of that is considered the chilling effect of laws that ban free speech or otherwise punish people for talking or expressing views.
So if pro-Israel students on campuses were disciplined or expelled or suffered repercussions for their defense of Israel, they would have a case.
Yeah.
But that the evidence of that is, I think, quite scarce.
Well, evidence, you know, chilling effect is, of course, much harder to show. It's a very real thing. But people, you know, Jewish students, as you describe, or pro-Palestinian students or faculty members, can and do experience a reluctance to express themselves if they think they're going to be punished.
There's massive evidence of that, of disciplinary procedures that have been increasingly criminalized, with courts defining, using the IRA definition, defining criticism of Israel as a form of anti-Semitism, so that then those become very, very real consequences if your activity is in violation of civil rights laws just by expressing support for Palestinian rights.
Any arrest or any disciplinary action or any firing reverberates. It not only impacts the person to whom that action is aimed, but it means all kinds of other people are not going to say or write what they really feel and what they really want to say or write.
So this will be something to follow as that trial with a bench decision concludes. It may have concluded even by the time our piece airs. Mike, are there other signs of hope for these hard and harsh times?
Well, actually there are. In addition to the active resistance by all kinds of people with their cell phones who are filming ICE and who are organizing against it in hotels and everywhere, there's also a lawsuit brought by those people that was just joined yesterday by 17 states, including states like Arizona, that are surprising, who are suing the ICE for stopping and seizing people without explanation and for its other blatantly illegal activities. So that's a powerful, it ups the ante considerably and means there may be more corners of resistance and pockets of opposition than I had hoped for before.
Where's what court is that case being filed at?
In Los Angeles right now. It's Los Angeles being supported by 17 state governments.
Well, that's something to follow. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, see you in court's one line, but it all depends on being seen in the streets, too.
Absolutely. Well, always, it takes both to get anywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Mike.
The crops are all in, the peaches are rotting. The oranges are piled in their creosote dumps. They're flying you back to the Mexico border. pay all your money to pay it back again. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita, adios mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. My father's own father, he waded that river. They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters, they worked in your orchards, rode the big trucks till they lay down and died. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita, adios mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deported. Oh, the sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon, a fireball of lightning that shook all our hills. Who are all these friends who are falling like dry leaves? The radio said they're just deportees. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita, adios mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. Oh, they will call you.
That was Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with their discussion of growing forms of resistance to the cruel, illegal, and unconstitutional deportations of immigrant members of our communities. The song you heard is called Plane Wreck at Los Gatos by Woody Guthrie. He wrote it in response to the 1948 crash of a deportation flight that killed 32 people, mostly deportees, rounded up during Operation Wetback, in which INS agents deported thousands of Mexican immigrants, including legal residents and U.S. citizens. The song reminds us that the violation of civil rights of immigrants is nothing new in this country and has been repeatedly deployed to sow terror and suppress dissent. That's it for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Joe Clement, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker, and a special thanks to our guest, Paul Messersmith-Glavin. Our gratitude as well to the McDeasy brothers for permission to air a segment of their podcast. Lastly, as always, a shout out to the workers at KABU who make all this possible. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Until next Monday morning, stay safe, and above all, stay active.